Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the Heart of Healthcare podcast. I'm Hallie Tecco.
And I'm Steve Krause. And every Monday, we bring you the latest in healthcare innovation as we sit down with entrepreneurs and industry experts.
So buckle up and join us as we figure out how to improve healthcare for all.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the Heart of Healthcare podcast. I'm Steve Krause. Today, I'm talking with Joanna Strober, the founder and CEO of an awesome digital health company called Midi Health. Joanna, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, Joanna, you've had a fascinating career, which I want to cover today. You started as a venture capitalist. I think you were a fund of fund managers, an author, a business school lecturer, and most recently, a serial entrepreneur in healthcare. And I want to touch on a lot of those because our listeners on Heart of Healthcare also come from a wide variety of backgrounds, and I'm sure they'll find great lessons from your life and your career. But let's start with what you're currently working on, Midi Health. Midi Health is an early stage startup building a virtual healthcare platform specifically for women in midlife. It's a virtual care clinic created by specialists in perimenopause and menopause. And I recently saw an awesome picture of you, Joanna, on Twitter rocking a shirt that said, "Menopause is hot," which I loved. And so I want you to tell us more about why both menopause and Midi Health are hot.
So we started the company actually thinking we were a menopause company, quite honestly. We were thinking a lot about giving women access to hormones. And historically, it's been really hard for women to get access to high quality hormone care. So that was really how we started the company. And what we have learned is that the opportunity is just much greater than that. Because it just turns out that women from around 35 to 65 are just massively underserved. And they have a lot of health issues that are coming up. A lot of them are regarding the top three, which is hormones, weight, and sex. But honestly, it's much more than that. And so what we have found is that we end up really taking care of a lot of health issues for women in this age category.
And so these are women who are obviously post sort of the childbirthing, you know, age and now into the sort of midlife, as you call it, of being a woman. And it shocks me given that how important this demographic is in terms of decision makers and frankly, probably spend in our healthcare system that it was ignored. Why is that?
So OBGYNs are paid to take care of babies.
Yeah.
Right. So
yeah.
They do a great job at taking care of babies. And then what happens is a woman delivers her child. Often she stops seeing a primary care physician because she goes under the care of an OBGYN. And then the woman actually has no place to go after that period of care. Some women just get fired by their OBGYNs or they don't have a home after that. So if you look at our population, 40% of the women who come to us haven't seen a doctor in 4 to 10 years.
Wow. And probably they've probably seen a pediatrician more than they actually seen a doctor for themselves,
exactly,
I imagine.
Right.
Yeah, interesting.
They've gone to the pediatrician and they've gone to urgent care for themselves, but they haven't done any of the basic care. We're getting women mammograms, we're getting them colonoscopies, we're getting them DEXA scans. Like, we're getting all the primary care done for them because no one has done that for them. But then we're partnering with healthcare systems around the country so that we have a place to send you to get your care.
So they view you as the health system who's frankly probably lost touch with this woman as a patient, other than probably interacting with them as a pediatrician or in urgent care. They view you as a way to re-engage with this segment of the population. And so you're the front end, the tip of the spear, MIDI, and then if there are downstream issues, you send them to your partner health system. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Interesting.
Honestly, we're diagnosing a lot of cancer. A lot of women are coming to us and they haven't had a mammogram.
Wow.
So we're getting the mammograms. I mean, we're basically starting with the core things that women need, and then we're discovering there's a lot of other areas that they need help with. So we really are tying them back into medical care.
And what is it that you can do virtual through MIDI? Like you said it was hormones, weight, and sex. So are those things?
Well, that's a joke.
Okay. So tell us about the suite of services that you can offer, and then kind of obviously if you're doing scans and cancer, you're referring them off to the academic medical center or the health system partner. But what are you guys able to do?
I mean, most of the things that women need in this age category do not require in-person care. So the truth is, if you want to talk about sleep or anxiety or joint pain, none of these things require in-person care. 90%+ of what women need during this age category doesn't require an in-person visit. It just requires someone to listen to you, to take the time to have the conversation, to prescribe the right medications, and then, if appropriate, prescribe blood tests, and then they interpret those. But, you know, essentially, most of the things that women need in this period of life don't require in-person care. Yeah. You only need a pap smear every 3 to 5 years. So it's not like there's a reason to go in for a lot of other things.
And how are you guys measuring outcomes? We like to talk a lot about outcomes on Heart of Healthcare because we're all trying to change the healthcare system for the better for all. How do you guys measure outcomes for your customers?
Yeah, so we use all the standard measurements. There's a menopause symptom standard, there are mental health standards, and we track all of that really closely. Our outcomes are pretty phenomenal.
These are patient reported outcomes.
96% of the women who come to us say within 2 months their mental health is better.
Wow.
That means they're not going on antidepressants, they're not going to therapy, just with the right prescriptions that we're giving them. 92% of them are sleeping, and this is within 2 months we're able to fix their sleep issues. 89% of them say their joint pain gets better. 68% of them are improving their weight, and that's without the GLP-1s. Hmm. So we are seeing pretty phenomenal outcomes on all of the care that we're giving, and we're tracking it really closely.
Yeah. We've talked about the GLP-1s, and obviously everyone's talking about them nowadays, right? How do you guys think about that in your suite of services that you offer for weight management for this segment of the population? Are you guys doing nutrition first and other metformin, other things? Are you prescribing, or are you just only doing sort of weight management counseling and then leaving prescriptions to other people?
All prescriptions. So we are prescriptions.
Okay.
We are not a counseling company.
Okay.
We are not nutritionists. We are prescriptions. But we do often start with hormones and metformin. Mm-hmm. And what we have found is that for a lot of women, that is actually sufficient. They mm-hmm. don't need the GLP-1s, but we are absolutely prescribing the GLP-1s. We're prescribing whatever is appropriate for the patient. So we don't do the counseling. We refer them elsewhere for counseling. We're just the medical care.
Okay, got it. And your go-to-market at MIDI is what? Is it through employers, payers? How does it work at MIDI?
Primarily right now, we are direct to consumer.
Okay.
And we have a lot of consumers coming to us.
Wow.
40% of it is word of mouth. So a lot of women come and then they tell their friends, which is great. But we're also, we have a lot of physician referral to us. So we get referrals from dermatologists, from primary care physicians. So we have a lot of cancer doctors who are referring patients to us. They actually take care of the cancer, but then that actually puts women into early menopause by their chemo. So then the doctors refer the patients to us to do the hormone treatment. Same thing if they do an oophorectomy or if they do a hysterectomy, then they refer the women to us for the hormone treatment afterwards. So there are a number of ways that that women are coming to us. And we are also getting a lot of referrals from employers as well.
So MIDI's super hot. I know lots of people talking about in the market, but I'm just curious. I mean, you've been a multi-time entrepreneur. We're going to talk about some of your previous experiences, and it hasn't always been up and to the right, but I'd be curious, what was the most challenging thing about getting MIDI started for you that, you know, in terms of getting off the ground, what was it in your journey so far?
It's funny, now it looks like it was really easy. People keep on telling me, oh, wow. Like, I mean, we're on track to treat over 100,000 women this year, and
wow,
we've only been around for 2 years.
Yeah, I know.
So we're growing really fast, and we have tapped into a market that people are really excited about and interested in. honestly, when we started 2 years ago, no one actually believed it. So yeah. It's not like it was like a, oh, no problem, I'll give you a lot of money to start this company. I don't think that most people that we talked to initially didn't understand the market. Maybe we didn't understand the market, quite honestly. I mean, as I said, like, we thought we were more of a hormone access company.
Yeah, like, that's when I first met you, that's what I thought. Menopause. And now you've brought into midlife, which I love.
But also, like, menopause, you know, people think menopause is older ladies, 60 years old plus, right, with gray hair. And what they don't realize is that perimenopause, which is the key here, starts around 35, right? So we really are talking a 35-year period of time. And the only reason I'm stopping at 65 is that right now we're not doing Medicare.
Okay.
But we can do older ladies too eventually. But think of it, this is like a very broad period of your life when you're not sleeping, you're starting to have depression or anxiety, you might have joint pain, you might have tingly ears, your hair starts falling out, you look are older, like all these things are happening to you. And honestly, you don't have any place to go to get taken care of.
And for my Y chromosome colleagues out there, and I admit maybe some naivete or ignorance on my part, can you tell me physiologically the definition of perimenopause and menopause? Because that's interesting to me. I didn't know that it was such a, you know, 35 years and beyond.
Yeah. So menopause means you haven't had your period for a year. That's all it means. And so when you talk about a menopause company, it doesn't really actually make any sense, right? Like, that is what it means.
Yeah.
Perimenopause, which is the period leading up to menopause, is the period of estrogen fluctuation. And essentially, women's estrogen goes up, and that's when they're very fertile in their 20s. And then estrogen starts going down in your mid-30s, and it starts fluctuating. And it's actually those fluctuations as it goes down that creates a lot of the havoc in our bodies. And there's probably 64 specific symptoms and even more that people are finding that are related to estrogen going down. By the way, that doesn't mean that you have to use estrogen to fix it. 70% of the women who come to us do go on hormone replacement therapy.
Yep.
But we have other prescriptions that we can offer, and we also have supplements, and we have lifestyle things. So you don't have to go on a hormone. But the important thing is that that estrogen fluctuation creates havoc in women's bodies.
Yeah.
And so understanding that is our role, and then understanding how to basically help you with all those symptoms that are coming.
Yeah, I was just saying, you said 64 symptoms, like the amount of specialty areas that you touch, which is why health systems want to work with, it's just fascinating. I mean, like, I learned, that's amazing. I mean, it must be almost every single ology has a downstream sequelae related to the core area that you're focused on at MIDI.
I mean, you know, we just launched this partnership with NeuroTrack, that a lot of research is starting to show that there's a correlation between estrogen and Alzheimer's, because women experience Alzheimer's at a much higher rate than men, and they think that's related to estrogen. So a lot of women are getting brain fog, right? And they're forgetting things, and they want to know, is this Alzheimer's? Or, you know, should I be thinking about it as Alzheimer's, or is it just brain fog? So, you know, we just launched a partnership with NeuroTrack so we can do that test and we can help you to find out. But that's just one example, right? Brain fog being a really important thing that women are experiencing. Or, you know, sleep. A lot of women are suffering from sleep challenges. That is directly related to your hormones as well. If you're not sleeping, then you start overeating and you start being, you know, less functional during the day, which has a lot of other effects all tied to it. So if you can get to the sleep issues without sleeping pills, just with either supplements or hormones, you can help women to sleep really efficiently without a lot of extra care.
We'll be back after the break.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
So So MIDI's doing great. Your previous company, I said, mentioned you're a serial entrepreneur before, and apologize if I characterized it, but it wasn't, I don't think it was as much of a rocket ship as MIDI, to be fair. It was a company called Curbo Health. I know you and I talked about it in the early days. We'll get back to our tie later in the podcast. But I'm curious, first of all, you could tell the audience what Curbo is focused on, and we don't have to go through the whole journey. Ultimately, I think it was acquired by Weight Watchers, so I want to talk about that experience. But really, what did you learn as a first-time digital health founder in your experience at Curbo that you could share? And there's probably many, many things you learned. But I'm curious, we have a lot of entrepreneurs with this podcast. What did you learn? And how did that shape how you went about MIDI?
I have a son, and he used to walk around the house saying, recurring revenue, recurring revenue.
He's meant to be a venture capitalist.
Exactly. But there were two huge challenges with Curbo that were almost unsurmountable. One of them was that people did not want to talk about their children's weight. So we had this website and it talked about weight. And then parents said, I really want this for my child, but I don't want to tell them that they're overweight. And so it was really hard to have that conversation.
So almost like patient engagement was hard. And because it was parent to kid, and that part of the parents wanted to engage with you, but the next step was really hard.
That's right. The parents really wanted it for their children, but it was very hard for them to talk to their children about it. So we had a lot of app downloads for our app, which we didn't make any money on. It was kind of it was something that was out there in the world. And the parents were really happy to give their kids the app to teach them healthier habits. But our money came from coaching. And that required the parent to actually talk to the child about their weight, and they didn't want to do that. So that was number one. And number two, and this is where the recurring revenue comes in, honestly, we taught you skills, and in 3 to 6 months, we didn't need to be there anymore for you. And so the skill building was there, and we taught you what we knew how to teach you, and then there was no recurring revenue. So that was a huge problem. And so that's the joke in my family, is that you had to find a 30-year value prop, not a 6-month value prop to make a company successful.
Interesting. Both markets very large, right? I mean, both markets, childhood obesity, huge market, right? Obviously, what you're doing at MIDI, huge market, but very different lessons in terms of how do you actually make the business work.
Well, also, I mean, one of our challenges with Curbo was we would get Medicaid contracts, which would take a year, right, to get the Medicaid contract in the state. And then we couldn't reach the patients. So, one of the most painful experiences was getting those phone numbers of kids in an area that were covered by Medicaid. They would know that these children were obese. And then we would call them, and none of the phone numbers were right.
Yeah.
And then it was depressing. And then there was one time in Houston when we actually were able to reach a significant number of people. We had an event for them, and the families all came. And honestly, the families came because they were hungry, not because they wanted their children to lose weight. And so there was just so many challenges in solving the childhood obesity issue. And there were so many multimodal facets to this challenge that it's a really big, important issue that a lot of people need to be working on, but it's tough. It's very tough for a venture-funded company.
Yeah. And ultimately, you made the decision to sell that company. Tell us about that moment. Honestly, in this market, there's probably more companies that look like Curbo, unfortunately, than look like MIDI by definition. I mean, you know that as a former venture capitalist. It's hard. It's impossible to do what you're doing as an entrepreneur. It's just really hard. And I think the lesson of when you're a founder, first-time founder, I knew how passionate you were about this idea. I mean, it was clear just talking to you. But there's probably that moment where you just got to sit and stare at the mirror and say, this isn't working, and we're going to find a home for it. Talk through that process and how you made that decision. I think it's interesting for entrepreneurs to learn.
It is. It's really hard. I have no illusions about how hard it was. For me, the most important thing at the time was that we were coaching a whole lot of kids. And so
how big did you get? Roughly, in terms of,
we were
numbers.
Doing thousands of kids a month.
Wow.
I don't remember exactly, but it was real numbers. And we could see that we were never going to get enough funding to build it into a big company. And so we could have shrunk the company and just kept going as a small little company, or I decided that we should sell. And my number one priority was finding the right partner who would do the right by my patients. And so that was really the biggest priority, is making sure, well, actually my employees, taking care of my employees and taking care of my patients. And so it was really clear to me that finding the right partner to sell to that would enable that to continue was my most important factor.
And you ultimately ended up selling to Weight Watchers?
Yeah,
correct.
Exactly.
And you worked there for a couple of years, or is that right? Or
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was that like? And I mean, not Weight Watchers specifically, but you know, a lot of founders have that is the ultimate outcome for a lot of companies, right? We all want to get our companies public, and it's a glorious moment when you do that. But most of the time, it's a sale to a strategic, maybe a private equity, and it's a different animal. I'm curious, what did you learn from that process?
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you a story, but
yes.
I mean, I learned a lot. I will say I did. I learned a lot. I learned what it's like in a big company. And actually, I learned why it's so freaking hard for big companies to innovate, right? Like that was, you know, you always think one of the big companies is going to win because it feels like from the outside, like a big company
with so many resources. Yeah, yeah.
Right? So you think that they can win. But once you're in a big company, you realize that innovating is really hard. And when I was working at Weight Watchers, I started looking at the weight loss medication industry.
Yeah.
And I started doing a lot of work. And this was in 2019.
You're like, hey, guys,
like, look at this.
There's an existential threat on the,
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that is actually what happened.
Wow.
I actually wrote this whole business plan.
No
about
way.
The existential threat. Yeah.
Wow.
And
it's three letters and one number.
It's a long story. Yes.
Wow.
It's a long story, but it was actually, I wrote a big business plan and it got turned down.
Wow.
For reasons that actually kind of turned out to be true. It was an existential threat, right? Like, what do you do when you're in a big company and you're like, do you see this big medicine coming along that's going to put you out of business? And they actually looked at it and they just couldn't, it didn't work for them to think about it at the time.
Yeah.
Quite honestly.
And you wrote a business plan that was specifically like, hey, guys, we're going to start a business unit that's going to kind of cannibalize our core.
Yeah, that's right. And that didn't work.
That must have been a really awkward meeting. Yeah, interesting. Interesting.
But I learned actually in that process, I learned how to start MIDI, quite honestly,
because
I learned how to set up a national medical practice.
Mm.
I learned how to get medications covered. I learned how to get the blood test done. I learned how to basically what it would take to set up a national medical practice. And so it was actually that learning that I did in that project that made me realize, oh, wow, like you can apply everything that I just did to hormones and to a market.
So you started off as a venture capitalist. In fact, you started off as a venture capitalist at Bessemer Venture Partners, where I now work. You were a tech investor, I believe, actually invested in Blue Nile, if I'm correct, which is a great.
And Baby Center.
And
I invested
Center.
In Baby Center when I was pregnant in 1998. Isn't that crazy?
So awesome. So I'm curious, you know, it's funny. I have... a lot of folks come to me and say, hey, if I want to get into venture, should I be an entrepreneur or work in an entrepreneurial company first? But I'm curious, the reverse of that, starting off as a venture capitalist, you know, I'm not sure whether you always had ambition to be an entrepreneur or not. What did you learn from that experience that has shaped you today and what you're doing, you know, you've done for the last, I guess, decade of your career?
It probably makes you more realistic about what venture capitalists know and don't know.
Not a lot. Yeah. Shoot, you revealed my secret here, Joanna.
certainly probably makes me a little more realistic about what you can and cannot expect from your venture capital partner.
What do you think you should expect from your venture capital partner, just to stick on that for a second, as an entrepreneur?
So one thing I'm finding is that you spend so much time as an entrepreneur focused on your company that your venture people can really help you by looking at what other companies and giving you feedback about what is working from other companies and what is not working, right? Like that feedback about the marketplace can be incredibly valuable. And then understanding who are good board members, understanding a good governance of the company, understanding strategies, those are all things that venture people can do incredibly well. I think, you know, don't count on them to run your company. And,
no.
And honestly, don't listen to them too much, quite honestly, because that's one thing that I think a lot of people mistaken and think that they, I mean, people show up at your board meeting once every few months, right?
Yeah.
You can't count on them to tell you how to run your company.
No.
So I think that a lot of people actually trust their boards too much at an early stage level, because you know your company far more than they do.
Yeah.
But what they can do is tell you where there's pitfalls, where really great venture capitalists can really see pitfalls because they've seen this from other companies and they've seen what's worked and what hasn't worked. And getting that guidance from them can be incredibly, can be great.
What did you learn personally that shaped your career from either your experience at Bessemer or just as a VC?
That's an interesting, so I learned a lot about, you know, what companies worked and what didn't work and what was important to make a company successful. I think that vision of getting to see a lot of companies and see things that are effective and not effective has made it, it has made an indelible impression of me. And I think about, you know, like the Baby Center founder or the Blue Nile founder. I mean, those companies are around 20 years later,
yeah,
right?
I know.
25 years later. Like those are companies that I funded as a child and now they're still around. It's because they had amazing entrepreneurs who found the right market and the right need and built companies around that market opportunity. And
yeah.
So it's pretty amazing to me. These companies that I funded so long ago are still around and doing well, but you know, many of them are not, quite honestly. So there's, we built both enduring companies and non-enduring companies. And I, you know, a lot of it is just around the people and
yeah,
how they think about starting companies and how they address those markets.
Yeah.
Also, honestly, like margins, like eToys, I funded eToys too, right? eToys was a great company with really bad margins. So some of it is just a business model question and making sure you have the right business model that's sustainable.
Yeah. That product, we say it a lot, product market founder fit. It's like one of those phrases that's used in books and stuff like, but it's like, if you get it right, it can really, I mean, it like, it can make a difference, but it's really freaking hard to get all three of those variables right. Right. So I totally buy that. And on margins, I'm just curious because this is a thing that our industry faces, right? And especially now, you know, I've been doing digital health for, I don't know, since digital health was founded, right? And it's been for a while, it was like a barren wasteland. Only a few of us actually did it. And then all of a sudden it took off with the pandemic. And now it feels like we're kind of in the doldrums. Although 2024 feels better for sure, I think. But margins are still a question for us, right? And I think how Wall Street views our industry and what is steady state margin for businesses like a MIDI. How do you think about tech-enabled service and how is this going to be viewed, not MIDI in particular, but our space when, you know, it matures? Because remember, we're only 10 years old as an industry. So it's going to take a long time for the capital markets to really understand us. But how do you think they get their heads around it? Because you've been an investor. You kind of know how they think. How do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, we think about this. This is what we think about all the time, right? Like, yeah. How do you deliver the average primary care practice? They have, you know, they see patients every, like 30 to 40 patients a day,
yeah,
right? Like 6 minutes a patient.
Yeah.
And that's how they're barely breaking even,
right,
in those practices. It's not like they're super profitable.
Right.
And so we're trying to figure out, is there a way using technology and not having an office that we can, you know, get good margins and still 15-minute visits or 30-minute visits and less of them? And so we think a lot about that and, you know, what technologies can we use? You know, we're using AI to try to make things as efficient as possible, to try to do the note-taking, to try to increase billing, to try to do the pre-auths. Like, what can we use technology to do to make it so that we're able to deliver our care, the really high-quality care that we want to do and have our providers not have to do anything else? So we're hoping we can use technology and we're getting better at using technology for that. Can we, you know, what else can we be offering to our patients so that we can increase our margin per visit? So we've been thinking about that. We actually launched an estrogen skin cream that we're providing for our patients that is actually a really good product. It's a compounded product, so you cannot,
oh, wow,
get it at the store.
And it's MIDI branded?
Right.
Nice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, so there are other things like that we can do to increase,
yeah,
our margins.
Yeah.
So we're going to test a bunch of different ideas on what we can do. We believe this can be a really good long-term sustainable business, but certainly you're right. Like, it's not going to have software margins. So we're going to have to figure out other strategies to increase our LTV and build a good business.
Well, I want to wrap up. We're in the last few days of Women's History Month, and I feel blessed. I'm the product of a woman who's sort of was a groundbreaker in corporate America and also an awesome mom, which is not an easy thing to do. And you wrote a book, I know, called 50-50 and taught
Getting to 50-50.
Getting to 50-50, thank you. And you were a guest lecturer, I know, at Stanford Business School around, you know, work and family and this topic of trying to get to 50-50. And you're clearly a trailblazer in our industry and I know a mom. And I'm just curious, you know, how have you been able to, like, what are some lessons you can share for women, for men? how you can be such a successful entrepreneur and also have kids and have an awesome life. I'm sure you've thought a lot about this given the work you've done. And I think it's a really important topic for us to cover in order for us to get to equity truly in our world and in our business world. So I'm curious, like, what are your lessons? What have you been able to learn over time in this challenge, in this struggle?
Steve, the book was called Getting to 50-50 for a reason, which is that you might never get there.
Yeah.
So, right, that's why we didn't call it
50-50. And 50-50 defined as work and life, is that the 50-50?
50-50 was actually defined as thinking of it as a scale between you and your partner.
Okay.
Between how you think about your work and how you think about your home life. Yep. And basically balancing those two things, right? And one of the concepts is that women have to be an equal partner at home and an equal partner at work, and men have to do the same. I'll tell you, I tell young women all the time, I've had 5 careers. Mm-hmm. I've had good careers. I've had less successful careers. I've raised 3 amazing kids. It was not all up and to the right. You know, there are times when it's really hard and there are times when it's less hard. And I think a lot of it is just about resilience and just kind of getting through, and then also really prioritizing what's important, and because you're always going to be prioritizing. And so figuring out each day what's important for your family and what's important for your job, and making sure you make the right trade-offs is really the key. There's no, like, you know, there's no secret sauce to this. I think you also have to cut yourself a lot of slack. You're just not going to be perfect the time at all these things. So that's another thing that I try to tell people.
Well, Joanna, I've always admired you personally. Just so happy for the success at MIDI, and frankly, for you, for the company, but also for, like, this huge part of population that was ignored. And clearly there's, you know, huge demand for what you guys are doing. So thanks for coming on A Heart of Healthcare and sharing a bit of your journey and MIDI's journey and your career lessons. Excited to see the future for MIDI.
This was really fun. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Heart of Healthcare. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe. The Heart of Healthcare is produced by Hallie Techo. The show is engineered, edited, and mixed by Kyle Moore. Visit our website, heartofhealthcarepodcast.com, for show notes and episode details.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.